Okay, so I was saying today we have two for the price of one. We're going to conclude our discussion of Judaism's view of Christianity. The core theological question, is this Avodah Zarah? Is it not Avodah Zarah? Is it idolatrous? Is it not idolatrous? And then we're going to segue to Islam and enjoy the gorgeous weather as we look at these relationships. So just to quickly recap, both for those who are here and those who were not here last time. So last time we focused on the question of the Jewish attitude toward Christianity. And we saw that there are fundamentally a couple of different schools of thought. On the one hand, you have the view of the Rambam. And the Rambam and many, many, many other medievals maintain very simply, Christianity equals Avodah Zarah. Open and shut case. After all, the belief in the Trinity, the notion that there are multiple aspects to the divine, is simply a violation of the fundamentals of monotheism. And despite the extensive censorship that we observed last time, right? The printed Rambam says, oh, the ancient Canaanites, they were idolatrous. But that's, of course, not what Maimonides actually himself wrote in his initial presentation. Instead, Maimonides actually wrote that Christianity, today's, in other words, the Rambam's time, today's Christianity, this is going to be for the next one. There's one. Does anyone have any extras? Or can anyone share? I'm sorry about that. Okay. If you don't mind. The Rambam, in his initial writing, says Christianity is idolatrous, and even though it's erased from numerous contexts of the Rambam's treatment. Others, however, disagreed, and there's this ambiguous view of the Tosafists. And the Tosafists come along, and they're trying to justify contemporary practice. The Rambam is living in an Islamic context, so for him to say that Christianity is idolatrous is theoretical for the most part. But when the Talmud comes along and says, you're not allowed to engage with idolaters in commercial transactions on or around the day of their holiday, that becomes very practical. How is someone who's living in medieval Christendom meant to make a living, given the limited range of options professionally that are available? Okay, there are very, very few. One of them, by the way, was more in Islam than in Christianity. No, but just, since the Shita's around here, Dr. Reichen coming is serving as a doctor. That was more in a little bit more. It was in both. It was both in Islamic and a Christian lens. So you could become a doctor, right? You could engage in money lending or other commercial transactions, but there really weren't too many options. So what are you going to do? And then there was the case of taking an oath in court. And he says, wait a second, how can I even sue my Gentile neighbor? In other words, how can I ensure some sort of level of fairness in our business dealings? After all, I'm causing that individual to walk into court and to swear in the name of a deity that I don't accept. And I'm not permitted as a Jew to cause anyone to sin, Jew or Gentile. We know that you're not allowed to place a stumbling block before a blind person, and the rabbis understand that as a metaphor. I can't cause others to sin. And it's very clear in the Gemara that if there's something that's prohibited for my Gentile neighbor, that I have responsibility toward that Gentile as well, religiously. I can't just... But that doesn't mean that we should walk around, correcting people all over the street. You know, you really shouldn't go to church on Sunday. You know, that's not the recommendation. But the idea that we bear some responsibility religiously toward not only our fellow Jews, but to all humankind, is part of the discussion as well. So Tosafists tried to justify requiring a Gentile to walk into court and to take an oath, and they actually insist that the halakha is that it's permissible, and they try to justify this. There's a whole range of explanations. One of them seems to be that it's not really idolatrous. That to believe in the Trinity is obviously inconsistent with fundamental Jewish beliefs, but that doesn't mean that it's literally rising to the level of pagan idolatry. Avodah Zarah is already a different category. That's what they seem to be saying, and they seem to indicate there's this intermediary category, something in between pure monotheism on one extreme and pure polytheism on the other. There's something called shituf, partnership, in which I can join the name of God with another deity. So Tosafos says, ironically, for it seems to say, this is the majority reading of Tosafos, for a Jew, shituf is proscribed, is prohibited, is almost idolatrous, essentially. But for a Gentile, there are looser standards. Jews are held to a stricter level in terms of what constitutes monotheism than the Gentiles, which is an interesting thesis in its own right. But bottom line, Tosafos is saying, it's not idolatrous for our Gentile neighbors, and therefore, one can engage in commercial transactions, one can take them to court, and so on and so forth. So these were these two fundamentally opposed schools of thought grappling with the issue that the Rambam and Tosos seem to have been divided on. Jerry, yeah.
Question, is there any distinction made, either by the Tosos, as you explained it earlier, but maybe later, I think there's between Protestantism and Catholicism, because Catholicism clearly has the iconography.
It's a great question.
And much more of the problematic appurtenances.
It is a great question. In the early modern period, we're going to look at some of those sources. The sources we're going to look at now don't specifically address, these sources don't address that. There is such a suggestion. It's not the majority view. And the reason it's not the majority view is because icons are separate from your conception of the divine per se. Right? In other words, the fact that I feel comfortable alluding to the deity by a physical symbol that we're uncomfortable with, by an icon, is not in of itself the core theology of how they conceptualize the divine. That being said, there are some who have greater objections to Catholicism for exactly that reason. So that's part of the discussion, for sure. So what I'm going to do now is, last time we had also seen the view of the Meiri. The Meiri was the most extreme school. Meiri said, not only is it not idolatrous, not only is it not shitof, this in-between category, but he basically says that all these seemingly discriminatory laws that appear in the Talmud, they're no longer applicable to the Gentiles of our day. He's living in southern France in a Christian milieu, and the Meiri, Rabbi Menachem HaMeiri, is living in the 13th century, comes along and says, basically, the Christians who live in my area, and we mentioned he had Christian friends. He was particularly, we know at least one Christian scholar with whom he was very friendly, someone by the name of Michael Scott, who at that time sounds like a very contemporary name. It was a 13th century southern French name, believe it or not, and they were actually close friends, a great scientist and thinker, and Meiri even refers to that relationship in one point of his writings, and he basically says that these laws don't apply because they were limited to the barbaric tribes of yesteryear. Those are far-flung, and maybe today, but some place where Jews are not living. Basically, today, it's different. And we started to have the conversation last time. Ruth, I think you mentioned at the end, you know, when is it just because you don't want to offend? How do we know that someone who's writing in the Middle Ages is really being honest with us? Maybe they're writing so positively because they don't want their neighbors to start a pogrom, right? That's actually quite a realistic concern back at, right? They don't want them to blame all of the Black Plague on the Jews, right? I mean, these are real concerns, the Crusades and so on. So this is a question. Almost any time someone says something like this, we have to analyze it carefully. And there's some debate about the Meiri, but in my opinion, and the overwhelming majority of that's among scholars, is that the Meiri did not only say this to avoid, he went well out of the bounds of what was necessary to bring people on board. So it seems like it was an authentic view. And he basically says they're not idolaters. We added that the Christians of his time, though, were Unitarians, at least in his immediate vicinity. So maybe Trinitarians would be a different kind of thing. In other words, they were considered, ironically, by the church, a heretical sect, which is funny from a Jewish perspective. But maybe that was part of it.
I was actually wondering about the Reformation. And did that have an effect on, I'm trying to remember when that was. Mm-hmm. you know, that, because they were rejecting, I'm not sure, the Trinity.
So that was that was what Jerry was referring to.
Yes, sorry.
So it's not, the core question is not really about the Trinity, but as Jerry said, but one of the key questions was in terms of iconography, and that's a major distinction. You can always tell a Catholic church by the cross that's outside, as opposed to a Reformed church, which will not. So that's the key difference. And as you're asking, and that is relevant to the discussion, but not quite in terms of the Trinity problem. So that's the thing. So one of the things, the next stages that we find that's fascinating, I just wanted to kind of bring to your attention, is if you take a look at the 16th and 17th centuries, sort of even to the 18th century, early modern period, and this is after what major event sweeps Western Europe, what might change or bring greater openness to the Jewish community? Less anti-Semitism, but what else?
The Renaissance?
Right?
Oh.
Post-Renaissance. Well, how does that affect Jewish thought? And by the way, you've got thinkers in places like Italy, which is where it begins. And you've got Jewish thinkers who are just like in our world, are grappling with their Jewish traditions and thinking about the general vicinity and asking how much of it is something that we reject and how much of it reflects truth and where do we draw the line. And there's no simple answer in the 21st century. There wasn't a simple answer in the 16th and 17th and 18th either. And so these questions remain with us. So this text is a little small. It came out on the copy machine, but there's some really interesting text I want to bring to your attention. Thank you very much. It's always the risk outside. What? You know, there is on the copier, but there wasn't on the Svarya sheet. It made it complicated. So what? I'm on page 13. And so I apologize, a little bit small, but I'm going to give you some fascinating examples. The first one is from someone by the name of Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, source 19. And these are photocopied. Last week I brought the book of Dr. Alan Brill, who is a scholar I mentioned. He occupies a Catholic chair at Seton Hall University, but he's a Jewish scholar. So he first of all, he cites someone by the name of Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi. And he gives you a little bit of the bio here in the first full paragraph. He lived from 1513 to 1585. He was a rabbi in Egypt, Italy, and Poland, which is not a combination that's typical. That's not in today's world and not in that world either. Very interesting. He was a rationalist in the cast of the Rambam, of Maimonides, and so he brings a certain Maimonidean openness. Even though the Rambam here in this case was opposed to Christianity as idolatry through and through, but his sort of rational approach allowed for later thinkers to say, you know what, we're not going to take these mystical themes and all the Gentiles demonic or something like that, and we're kind of going to, we look at them, when they treat us, when they seem like mentioned, they are mentioned. When they seem like decent human beings, they are decent human beings. So that's sort of that kind of approach.
Even though they called us demonic.
What?
Even though many of them called us demonic.
So things started to change in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, right. but you're right, it was far from the end of anti-Semitism, to say the very least. So now, Ruth, this is for you again, because this is in a particularly polemical, giving you credit where credit is due, but this is in context of an especially sensitive text, which we say at the Haggadah. If anyone was here when Rabbi Ephraim Kannerfogel spoke at the end of March, I don't know if anyone was able to attend that lecture, but he discussed this, the passage in the Haggadah where he asked God to pour out his wrath against the nations. Shvoch chamatcha el hagoyim, etc. It's four verses long. We ask God to pour out his wrath against our enemies. As Rabbi Kannerfogel pointed out, those who were here might remember, the initial version of that text was much longer and even uglier, for lack of a better term, more explicit and violent than the text that remains with us, and was written in an Ashkenazic context in which events like the Crusades were being wrought upon the Jews. So it was not some vindictive Jewish community. These were Jews whose very existence was questionable, and our survival was under threat by our Gentile neighbors, tragically. So in that context of discussing that source, he makes a comment here. Anyone good for reading small text? Anyone want to give it a try?
I could read.
Any volunteers? Yeah, Jerry?
Where is the source?
Good. From where he brackets it toward the bottom of page 13, sort of where it says, pour out thy wrath upon the nations.
Pour out thy wrath upon the nations. Some of the Gentiles among whom we were exiled under their protection have thought that, God forbid, we are cursing him. It only applies to the nations that do not know him, that deny the exodus from Egypt because they don't accept the miracles and wonders. It is quite clear that the Gentiles among whom we are exiled all know about the exodus and believe in it and know its details. We only curse the idol worshippers who don't believe in creation and who destroyed the temple, not the nations who became Edom and Ishmael, parentheses, Christianity and Islam, because they were still not created. But now our Gentiles and the Ishmaelites know God and acknowledge the Exodus. Forfend for us to curse them from our religion. And when we do curse those who afflict us and unjustly persecute us, that curse is not from our religion, forfend, but as a person who curses one who afflicts another. Our Holy Torah announces this in the name of the head of the faithful, Abraham, that God does not desire this, as it is written, Will you destroy the righteous with the wicked? End quote. And the master of the prophet said, one person will sin and the whole community should be cut off. Oh, it's a question mark. One person will sin and the whole community should be cut off. And from the writings, it is clarified that we are not allowed from our religion to curse nations that acknowledge the exodus from Egypt and know God, even if they have not received the Torah.
Okay, so at the Haggadah, we say, pour out thy wrath against the nations and against all the kingdoms that don't know you, and so on and so forth. So comes along Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, writing in the 16th century. What does he say? He says, which nations are those? And it sounds like the Meiri that we quoted earlier, right? Which nations are those? Oh, right. That's the ones. That's like the Egyptians who, even when they saw the explicit hand of God, they still denied the possibility of miracles. They still rejected the divinity, right? In other words, it was so flagrant, they simply rejected. But today, these are fundamentally not idolatrous peoples. Very clear. Not idolatrous. Right? The Ishmaelites, the Christians, it doesn't refer to them anymore.
Well, isn't this really problematic, since, as you just pointed out a couple of minutes ago, that Shokamatah was written in the communities affected by the Crusades?
Yeah, 100%. So I don't know if he knew the history of Shokamatah, right? So in his defense, he might not have known, but I don't think that it's actually historically compelling. I think that that's right. And
can you speak up a little bit?
Sure.
So much background noise.
Sorry. No problem. The question was raised, after all, wait one second, we just pointed out this text was initially written in an Ashkenazic context. So in other words, by the community that was suffering from the Crusades and from anti-Semitism and at the hands of the Christians specifically. So Paya asked and said, isn't this problematic? To say that this text refers only to ancient nations like the Egyptians, it's in context of the Haggadah, so it refers to the Egyptians and people like them, but not to today's Muslims and today's Christians. And I said, she's right. I said, he may not have known the history of this text, but now that we do know about the history of the text, probably it's not historically accurate to say that it was referring to the Egyptians. But my interest for our purposes is not so much what that text initially meant, but rather how it was being read in the 16th century. And this is far from the only text. We find many, many Renaissance texts of leading Jewish thinkers saying, you know what? It's true that they were Gentiles, but that were objectionable and that we needed to speak out very strongly against, but that is historically bounded. That was contingent upon the way in which they treated us, but not representative of a whole world view in which they're all idolatrous and they're all wrong and we reject all of them and so on and so forth. So I think I'm reading it not so much for how he takes the passage from the Haggadah, but for his own theology.
Can I suggest?
And what's his example? What's his proof text? Did you catch that in the last paragraph that Jerry read? What's his proof text?
I couldn't hear Jerry.
No, but in this text, what's the proof? What does he bring? How does he know that we don't call for the death of all non-Jews?
Bereishit Avraham.
Will you destroy the righteous with the wicked?
Good. Who's he quoting? Abraham in what? In Abraham and
Sodom.
Right, Abraham and Sodom. Right. God declares that the evil, wicked city of Sodom is going to be destroyed. And how does Abraham respond? Famously, what does he say? Hashofet ko haaretz lo ya'aseh mishpat. Will the judge of the entire world not perform justice? How can it be that God, you, the all-merciful one, would allow a catastrophe like this to take place, and you're going to destroy all the entire city? The sinners together with the righteous does not make sense. So if Shvochamascha were about all Gentiles in all places, our patriarch's argument would have been irrational on its face. It would have been counter to Torah values. Jerry, yeah.
So I'm going to suggest, I'll be bold enough to suggest a middle ground on the Shvochamascha.
Yeah.
Perhaps it's a dog whistle, meaning a dog whistle.
To borrow from contemporary political discourse.
Meaning that it was, the Jews knew that it was intended, it was targeted to the Crusaders, but it was phrased in such a way as to make it sound as if it was against the pagans in ancient times.
Right, give them an out.
Right.
No, that could be. I don't think Rabbi Elazar Ashkenazi is thinking that,
from what we know.
But yes, I think that there's legitimacy to that for sure.
So the other question I have regarding this text is the characterization of Edom, because...
Yeah.
I mean, and this he had to be aware of, because historically, I mean, the Ramban, for example, is very clear that he equates Edom with Rome and...
Right.
Not exactly friendly way towards the Jews. So, you know, this is sort of a refashioning of who Edom is in a way that...
For sure.
Sure, and that doesn't even appear to be accurate to the, the Masorah.
Right. Although in fairness, I think it's a good question, although in fairness, biblical Edom, we now know, was almost certainly not genealogically the precursor to Christianity, or even Rome for that matter.
Yeah, that's true.
It's very clear. Edom was a tiny little nation. They didn't destroy us. They mocked us, and they were not nice to us.
But it's very
clear from the book of Ovadia that they mocked us as we were exiled along the side of the road.
And they stood in the way. They wouldn't allow us to pass through there on the way from the Midbar.
You're saying biblical, right? In the initial, right? Yeah, 100%. Even earlier, biblically, right? 100%. So it's true what you say, but I'm just saying the medievals also were working under a certain set of assumptions. And while it's true that there's quite the powerful stream of that, I still think that there was space for a serious Achron to come along and give a different reading of that. In the end of the day, to some degree, it was rooted in their historical experience, and I think we have to be honest about that. I gave you a couple of other texts. We're not going to read all of them inside, but let me give you a quick, so as not to strain everyone's eyesight too much, but even smaller, I'll just tell you what these are, and if you want, you can bring your magnifying glass later on, and I'm happy to work it through with everyone. The top was what I mentioned last time, that I could not pass up the opportunity to quote a great scholar and biographer of the Tosafos Yom Tov, who is Rabbi Yom Tov Heller. It gives you the dates here, 1579 to 1654. And of course, the great biographer of the Tosafos Yom Tov is none other than our own Joseph Davis, Joe Davis, who lives right here in the community and attends Lower Merion Synagogue, literally, those who know where I typically sit in the main sanctuary, literally a row right in front of me. Like I daven to first to Joe and then to the Aron, as it were. Speaking of idolatry. So Joe and I mentioned last week briefly that I had read this book probably some 15 years ago, which is a good decade before I met Joe Davis. And we walked into Lower Merion Synagogue and I introduced myself. Hi, what's your name? He says, I'm Joseph Davis, Joe Davis. And I say, oh, that's interesting. I recognize that name. Do you know anything about the Tosafos Yom Tov? He says, it just so happens that I do. And so I quickly figured out who my great scholarly new friend was. So Joe Davis literally wrote the book on Tosafos Yom Tov and is, I think, without question, the greatest living scholar of the Tosafos Yom Tov living in the world today, which is a substantial achievement in its own right. And Dr. Brill quotes his biography here in his treatment of this discussion of our issue. And again, we won't read it inside, but essentially he maintains that the Tosafos Yom Tov, who was living a little bit later than Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi and living in Poland, was... And Prague and Vienna was a part of this trend of greater openness that saw Christianity, Christian neighbors, as non-idolatrous and not purely in polemical terms or context, but rather as a genuine position. He quotes the view of others. They maintain that when it says that all human beings are made B'Tselem Elokim, it means... all human beings are created in the image of God, and essentially he therefore maintains that we should have a positive disposition toward our Christian neighbors and that they are not to be considered to be idolatrous as well.
Excuse me?
Yes.
Are there any circumstances of behavior that by which a person really so betrays the notion of Tzelem Elokim that he, she, I'm thinking of the Nazis.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of, you know, contemporary times where the biggest haters of the Jews are not idolaters. I wouldn't call Muslims idolaters.
Right, right.
But if they're a certain portion of them really have the destruction of the Jewish people and Israel as on their agenda, and indoctrinate their children from the beginning, Shvachat Amadcha doesn't seem so terrible.
It's a great question. It is a challenge, and it's a separate shir, I think, in its own right, for sure. I'll quote one opinion, which is that of Rav Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik used to quote his father, who maintained that Amalek is not a race, but an ideology. Amalek is not a race, but an ideology. And that in every generation, there can be an Amalek who stands up against the Jewish people and whom we have an obligation to destroy. He held, certainly, that Hitler qualified as such. He also held, it was very explicit and very blunt, that the Mufti of Jerusalem qualified. The Mufti of Jerusalem was the one who was the rabble-rouser who caused the Hebron riots in 1929 that decimated the Jewish community of Hebron and was a real tipping point in terms of, until that point, there were simmering issues, but that was really a completely transformative moment in terms of Jewish-Arab relationships in Palestine at that time.
He was also a Nazi collaborator.
Absolutely. Yes, later on.
Meeting with Hitler.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. So, which is part of it. Absolutely, there's no question about it. So that's a short answer, but it is worthy of discussion. There's also a difference between when someone is living and after death. So here's an interesting question. So America killed Osama bin Laden. I think it's fair. I'm happy to group him together with those, right? It's not going to, right? Do you remember how they were cheering?
Yeah.
I remember delivering a drasha that after that Shabbos, you know, should you cheer in the stands for the death of Osama bin Laden? The baseball stadiums, they stood up and they announced and they were cheering. So here's the question, though. Is it, leaving aside strategic considerations, because they buried him at sea and all of that, and that was for very specific political reasons. But leaving all of that aside, let's say there were no political considerations. After such an individual, such a mashukat, such a despicable human being dies, does the body deserve a proper burial? Does the body deserve a proper burial?
After
we killed bin Laden. Right, after we found Hitler's body. After he committed suicide. We'd recovered the body. What?
We did?
What happened? What's the story?
Had we recovered?
I don't think we did.
Maybe their afterlife isn't up to us.
Right, but also...
But should we treat the body with dignity from a Jewish halachic perspective? Tzelem Elokim is during life, but there's also Tzelem Elokim. One of the manifestations of Tzelem Elokim is how we treat the body after death.
So what's the answer?
I haven't seen extensive discussions because we haven't. And how many times did we have it? Well, what did we do with Eichmann's body?
I'm sure that's the answer.
I'm sure. Right? Of course,
But
it's easy.
There's the political considerations.
There always will be.
The larger ramifications of his followers and you know how to deal with those after effects.
What did we do with Eichmann?
I don't know.
What happened with Eichmann?
Well, Hitler never found
him. What did they do?
Eichmann, I think they also in the Mediterranean or something.
The reason I was told it was the
bin Laden. Yeah. They didn't want his burial place to
become a shrine.
Exactly, they didn't want a shrine.
Because it was 1961. Okay, so it was still soon. There were still active Nazis probably, and it wasn't. That's interesting. It's a separate discussion. I have some further thoughts about it, but another time.
So I would argue that maybe it barbarizes us if we don't. I mean, that's a separate question that we should always keep to our standards. You know, it's not for us to judge that. You know, why? I mean, we're not God. You know, we have to conduct ourselves in a certain way vis-a-vis other human beings.
That's the tradition that I've received from my teachers, which is different than during when they're alive, in other words. But
I see.
When prisoners are executed in this country, I believe they return the remains to the family.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things, and I think that's one of the...
It's not mass murder.
Right, but Emily's asking, does there come a point at which, and we're talking about a 0.01% of society just for that select group, you know. Is that already different? All right. So I just want to Go ahead.
I guess I'm sort of in a contrarian mood today. Could you comment on what Joe Davis means about Maimonides' universalism? Because Maimonides is absolutely...
It's a great question. So I said earlier that the Rambam himself declared Christianity to be absolute idolatry.
Right.
And what I said earlier, though, I think holds here, so for Eliezer Ashkenazi, holds here as well, which is that there was a streak of Maimonidean thought which led devotees of the Rambam's more rational philosophy to be more sympathetic to Gentiles who treated us with menschlichkeit.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, what you see is what you get. The mystics and the Kabbalists tended to see these in terms that were associated with the soul of the Gentile. All right, they would say that there's a difference between the soul of a Jew and the soul of a Gentile. A Maimonidean rationalist would not see it that way. Would see the soul of a Jew and a Gentile as fundamentally the same, and yet we have an additional set of opportunities and responsibilities through our having been chosen by God through Avraham Avinu and then giving the Torah and so on and so forth. So while the Rambam himself maintained that Christians were idolaters, there's a streak of his thought that leads one to be more sympathetic. And remember, it was the Rambam himself who said that God had brought Christianity and Islam into the world to pave the way for the Messianic era. The same Rambam, so last week, who said that Christianity is idolatrous because it helped lead the world from paganism, from polytheism, to something much closer to monotheism. Mm. So the same Rambam who called them idolaters in the case of the Christians. So you can start to see how, even though he said what he said, it could be used in a certain kind of direction. Mm. I gave you as well, I'm not going to go through it now, but I'll bring it to your attention, Rav Yaakov Emden, who's writing a little bit later, who's writing in the second part of the, toward the end of the 17th century. And Rav Yaakov Emden is very interesting. He claims, he's part of this movement of a new openness to Christianity, and he claims something that a new group of scholars today have maintained, namely that the founder of Christianity, that Jesus, did not call for the abolition of mitzvot, did not call for leaving traditional Jewish practice, but himself was, he doesn't quite say from a Yid, but he does say, certainly against the Rambam. The Rambam says he led everyone astray and was a terrible person, all sorts of terrible things, and calls them all sorts of names. And Rav Yaakov Emden maintains that actually he was a well-intended Jew who went somewhat off the derech. His later students then, including Paul, who then created a completely different faith community, and that was really the end of the relationship between Judaism and Christianity. And this is part of his claim that in its core, at its heart, and in its soul, Christianity is much more amenable to Jewish thought than we might otherwise think, we might otherwise imagine. He actually reinterprets the New Testament. This is you have to just understand. This is a traditional rabbi with had a very long beard and had, you know, a big hat, you know, the whole nine yards. It was not, and didn't go to university. I mean, like, none of that stuff. But as part of the spirit, had a certain kind of openness to Christianity. There's a scholarly debate actually nowadays about this issue, about what was that first generation, the first decades of Christianity. So there are three schools of thought. There's one school of thought that basically he called for the abrogation of mitzvot and they're already invented something completely different. There's another view, the opposite end of the spectrum is like this, is to say that it was actually much more mild than we think in that first decade. Speaking of people who are rabble-rousing and like to bring attention to themselves, Rabbi Shmuley Boteach wrote a book, you'll forgive me, he wrote a book in which he claims that much more positive approach, and it's based on one of his teachers, I forget the name of the scholar, who maintains that way. I don't believe, however, that that's currently scholarly consensus. Currently scholar consensus is somewhere in between. That he did not call for the founding of a new religion, but he sharply critiqued the Pharisees, he sharply critiqued the rabbis of his generation, and not only called for a greater emphasis on the spirit of the law, but did contradict himself or did have different things to say about the observance of mitzvot, maybe went back and forth, but raised fundamental questions about their importance to faith, and so somewhere in between. So in other words, he really did start a process, even though he didn't you know, take us, take or take them all the way there at that time. But Rav Yaakov Emden is absolutely fascinating the way he talks about the New Testament. And then I gave you the last one that I wanted to mention was Rav Hirsch. So now moving toward the 19th century already, living in Germany in the mid-19th century, Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch also in his works specifically says that he's living in a Christian environment as well, that the Germans of his time are not to be viewed as idolaters, that we're meant to have respect for them. There are fundamental points of disagreement, but that does not mean that we can't be respectful. And indeed, this was part of Rav Hirsch's engagement with general culture at his time, right? Whether it be opera, or whether it be going to theater, right? Listening to the greatest composer of his generation. He wrote Hespeden for Gentile composers. Really? Very interesting kinds of things. So he had other ways in which he was actually quite Haredi. He was very receptive to the Gentile community, but he was very separatist, is correct, and very antagonistic toward the Reform movement, which had just become a force. Because at that time, Christianity was less of a threat, he felt, than Reform. And so that affected the dynamic. So ironically, the Jewish community had much greater difficulty with, in certain respects, than the Gentile community at his time. So in sum, this is obviously only the beginning, but we have seen a couple of the basic schools of thought about Christianity, about general tolerance and openness, but specifically this core debate as to whether or not Christianity is idolatrous or is not idolatrous. And what I want to do is to at least begin the transition now to talk about Islam. So I'm going to pass around the next, this is the two for the price of one. So here's the two.
Rabbi J.J. Schachter is an expert on Rabbi Emden.
Yes, he wrote his dissertation on Yaakov Emden, right?
Right, so he was supposed to come out with a book. Do you know if it ever came out?
You know, I didn't get to ask him over Shabbat.
I was looking for it.
He's been working on the biography for many years.
Right.
It's not published yet. I don't know the story with it.
He told me about it 15 years ago.
I know he's been working at it for some time. I don't know the story with it. He's involved in a lot of the...
I had a chance to ask him last
week. He's involved
in
many important... community activities, but I didn't ask him about it over Shabbat. I did not. You can find his dissertations online. He's got some great material from Yaakov Emden. Okay, so let's turn to Islam. At first glance, Islam is an open and shut case, and in a way, it is. Right? If Christianity is more complex because of the Trinity, Islam, well, obviously there are fundamental differences and fundamental points of disagreement between Judaism and Islam, including questions about the prophet, whether Moshe Rabbeinu was the last great prophet or Muhammad superseded him is a fundamental dispute. There's no question about that. Whether or not what we call Tanakh, or not the Bible, is the final word of canonized texts, or that the Quran is to be added to that, and there are other fundamental differences. They have their five principles, and we have a different set of mitzvot, and obviously they believe, just like Christians believe in a form of supersession, so too they believe in their own form of supersession. So, of course, there are very basic differences, but on the question of idolatry, the Islamic conception of the divine would appear to be
monotheistic, rigidly,
and in some ways, speaking of icons, they're even more stringent than we are in terms of what you can portray and so on and so forth. They're even more extreme than Jews in terms of art and the like. So,
and music and...
Right, and other things, which is not disconnected, but I mean in terms of issues that are somewhat connected to the conception of monotheism, right, nonetheless. So at first glance, this would be an open and shut case, and there are all sorts of fascinating potential halachic ramifications to this. So for example, we didn't talk about this in context of the church, but we could spend time on this as well. May one enter a church, may one pray in a church, and the general rule that one may not. And there are questions about museums and so on and so forth. You know, if you go to the Sistine Chapel, something like that, those are shilas, etc. But those are shilas, right? Those are serious halachic questions that need to be addressed. What about walking into a mosque?
Permissible.
Which you would think it's permissible. And in fact, recently, there was some discussion about this. Another Rabbi Shmuley, who tends to make the headlines, is Rabbi Shmuley Yankelevich, who is stationed out of Arizona. I think out of Phoenix, I want to say. Anyone know? I think out of Phoenix. So Rabbi Shmuley Yankelevich has a big on social media following, and he is the director of something called the Valley Beit Midrash, which is a Beit Midrash that's interdenominational. And recently they had a group of their, I guess, their fellows or students or something like that, went and visited and prayed in a mosque. And he posted about it, and this is a picture that I took from his Facebook page, and it was about an article on matzav.com. Anyone familiar with matzav.com? Matzav.com is like the yeshivaworld.com. So if anyone from the yeshiva world, anyone following these things? These are from the, I don't do this for fun, I promise, but there are people who follow these things for fun. These are more, I guess, Jewishly right-leaning online organizations that give a more Haredi kind of spin on the news of the day. They're not so Haredi that they can't be that Haredi,
because they're happy.
Yeah. They, apparently they didn't know about the Asifa, or maybe they're, you know, talking about the Asifa 5 years ago, the big anti-internet rally, and Citi Field, I believe, is that right? And the like, but they have, but or maybe they have a special heter, I'm not sure what the story is, but they do have more Haredi sympathetic kinds of views that are publicized here, and they were very critical, and they said, open Orthodox Rabbi Yankelevich gushes about davening Ma'ariv in a mosque. Right, so they came out to get him, and he wrote back, he responded, this angry ultra-Orthodox news site loves to follow me and share my Facebook posts. Right, in other words, they're giving me free press, so there. Here they're mad at because I prayed in a mosque. What they don't know is that Rav Avadia Yosef, one of the greatest halachic authorities of the 20th century, wrote when he was head of the Cairo Basin that if one cannot find a shul to daven in, that it's better to pray in a mosque than just on one's own.
That is really hard to believe.
What? In fact, I think it's wrong, and I think it's incorrect. I know the tshuva that he's referring
that he said
to.
That? You think it's incorrect that he said that?
Rav Avadia Yosef, I don't think, said that.
Oh, okay.
What?
Incredible.
Well, I looked at the, I mean, I know, look, there's a classic tshuva on Yabia Omer, one of Rav Avadia's tshuvos, and actually when I was preparing the shir, I looked at it. I think I gave it to you somewhere here. I don't know if we'll get to it today or next time. But Rav Avadia says that if you don't have a shul to daven in, that it's permissible to pray in a mosque. But I didn't find anywhere where he says that it's better to pray in a mosque, that a mosque has like some sort of kedusha, space aknesses or something like that. Seems odd. Now, maybe, just to be clear, I looked in the classic Tshuva Rav Avadia Yosef and I didn't find it. And other people critiqued him on a social media page and he didn't offer a response. Now, it's possible that there's something that I don't want to say. I didn't ask him myself and I want to give him that respect. But at the same time, I did look at the Tshuva and it does seem a little bit incredible. But that's suggested. But hold on 1 second, sorry. But the basic point, for leaving aside this controversy in this question, but the notion of praying at a mosque might seem a little bit foreign to us, uncomfortable, and I don't think for bad reasons. But at the same time, Ma'aras HaMachpelah is a mosque.
Yeah.
And I just think it needs to be said.
That
seems distinguishable.
Good, because it was initially ours.
Yeah.
Right.
We're not going, it may be part of a mosque, but we're not going
in the same space,
sanctuary
in the same
of a mosque to pray. We're going into the Ma'arat HaMachpelah,
which happens to double as something else. There's a question if that matters or not, but it feels different for sure.
This certainly dates me, but in 1968, I went into the mosque on the
Omar,
right,
the blue one.
Yeah, I took my shoes off and I went inside just to see, because I do these things. I look at and cathedrals in France.
And it was possibility in 1968. You can't do it anymore.
I was in there also in 1972.
Right, but
when did that stop? When did it? When?
I mean, it was very simple to do at that time. You just walked in. You left your shoes outside, right at the edge. I mean, nothing at all. And yeah,
I can't. That's what's so remarkable. I can't imagine
that the feeling in that.
But it stopped. It changed.
Was that Dome of the Rock?
I was there, I think, in either 70 or 72. Those were my first two trips to Israel.
Was it the Dome of the Rock or was it the Mosque of Omar?
Because no, it was the. It wasn't the Dome of the Rock. It was the gold one, not the silver. Not the silver.
The Mosque of Omar.
Well, not the one that was
off to the side.
Back in those days.
Some of the French, you know, the famous French cathedrals.
Yeah.
And I have to say, there, for me at least, there was a sense of sacredness
with a capital S, that's meta religion, right, specifically.
I mean, it was just a tourist site. I remember we were a group of kibbutz kids going with a guide.
I wasn't going there to pray.
I just walked up there, and it was just part of the tour,
right,
you know?
Right, I went myself, or with friends, whatever it was. But the point is that these experiences have led me to believe that there is something called the sacred that supersedes any specific,
like Addo writes, Rudafado,
any of the particular approaches, because the architecture really does capture,
inspire.
I think so,
and I think sometimes I think we don't necessarily experience it on a day-to-day basis here in that same kind of way. There's wisdom to that. There's wisdom to that for sure. So in sum, although it seems awkward, and the point of this is not to paskin about davening in a mosque,
right,
but it seems awkward, but the truth is it is quite clear that the halachos of davening in a church or even entering a church are treated very differently than entering a mosque because, one, in the former, there's a dispute about it standing as idolatry, and in the latter, it would seem, at least on its surface, that there's no question whatsoever. Nonetheless, we find some fascinating... We don't find the suggestion that the theology of Islam is truly polytheistic. That's just patently absurd. That's not plausible, really. Although, we'll see, it's a little more complicated than that. But at least Islam as we know it today, as we'll see. But what we do see is a fascinating that dispute that does develop about its status, vis-a-vis questions such as, if someone puts this as the ultimate test, the question of martyrdom. Question of martyrdom. If someone places a gun to my head and says, right, you must either become a Muslim or worship the Islamic faith or give up your life, what's the halacha?
Rambam says you should convert. Right?
Rambam says you should convert, that's right, because we're going to see that. I cited the letter here. Excellent. Mm-hmm. Very good. Right? But that's not such a simple matter, right?
Yes.
That becomes already... Now, hold on one second. But the reason one gives up one's life is for idolatry. Right? There are the three cardinal sins. If Islam is not idolatry, no one thinks under normal circumstances that, and obviously that's to leave the Jewish faith, that's become a meshumen in a way. That's horrific. That's not the desired outcome, right? Even if there's the concept of the capital S sacred, nonetheless. But when push comes to shove, must one give up one's life? That becomes a major matter of dispute. And that becomes one of the sticky points. The other seems less and is less consequential, but was practical over the course of many, many centuries, which is the question of touching by a Gentile wine. When it comes to wine, we know there's a category of yayin nesach. If a Gentile touches maga nesach, right, or maga goy, and with regard to yayin nesach, or staminum it's called, if a Gentile touches or pours the wine, so that renders it prohibited. In fact, I remember there was a story, someone had Gentile friends and family over at the Seder table one year. They had also a collection of all sorts of exotic people who would always come to their Seder, and one time there happened to be a number of Gentiles who happened to be present at their Seder and were invited, and never mind what happened when they got to Shvuach HaMascha. That's another story for another time. A good story about that too. But the tradition was that you had to pour the wine.
Right.
Some people do this, right?
Right?
One for someone else at the Seder.
Right.
Anyone did this in your home? It's not uncommon. So they're trying to figure out exactly how to handle that. And then that was their custom. They wanted to fulfill that custom. So what they declared at the beginning of the Seder, they said, tonight, everyone is a free person in our home, and therefore we, the hosts, are going to be pouring wine for everyone.
But wasn't it their solution?
They checked and it wasn't Mavushal, as it turned out. So that was an issue. And maybe they brought it as a gift, you know? We went and we bought kosher wine, you know, like that. You felt like you had to use it, felt obligated. Okay, so this is something that still remains practical, but isn't as big an issue. There were times in the Middle Ages when in certain areas, in Ashkenaz in particular, when basically there was nothing to drink other than wine. People actually, for many, many years, the water was considered to be toxic,
right,
was dangerous to drink, and it was a real issue. So that's the other question that came up. So what I want to do is we're going to spend a few more minutes on this today, and then we're going to transition for next time to conclude it. But I want to share with you that there are two fundamental schools of thought here as well. The first school of thought that we're going to see essentially says what you might have thought, which is that Christianity might or might not be idolatrous, but not Islam. That's clearly the case. This was certainly the view of the Rambam. Certainly the view of the Rambam. Christianity is idolatry, and Islam is not. Very clear cut in the Rambam. So if you take a look, for example, source 2, and we did this last time, but to review it here in this context as well. So he says in Perak Yud Aleph Halacha Zayin of Hilchot Machalot Asurot 11:7, he says that if you have a ger toshav, right, which is a Gentile who is living in the land of Israel and accepts the seven Noahide laws. So there's certain laws that govern such an individual. And then if you jump to the next page, the Rambam writes that if a person is not an Ovei Kochavim, if a person is not idolatrous, if you take a look at the first of the Hebrew and the English, okay, go in top line on page 2, Elu Hayishma'elim, like these Muslims or Ishmaelites. And this was not censored. In the right, because this is a nice thing to say, right? They're not idolatrous. The Christian part that was left out of many of the texts of the Rambam, this was left in. Says there are different laws. There's still prohibitions, but they're less severe than when it comes to idolaters in English.
So what is the rationale for splitting it, that you could have hana'a but not drink it?
So there's an additional rabbinic overlay, lest one come to have the same thing performed by a true idolater. That's why it's only rabbinic, not biblical, and that's why there's greater leniency. And I take a look at the English, the way he says it, and so too any Gentile who does not worship the stars and the constellations, such as the Ishmaelites, their wine may not be drunk, but one may derive benefit from it.
Do the Ishmaelites pray to constellations?
No,
that's
no,
they don't. And
they
that's
don't.
Why you can derive benefit.
Oh, that's why you can, right, yeah. Oh, okay.
That's right.
How do you derive benefit from wine without drinking it?
Sell it. That's the most, yeah. I mean, yes, that potentially as well, that's a possibility, but certainly in terms of profiting from it.
But isn't there a prohibition on alcohol consumption in Islam?
Sure, but if they...
So how could they make wine?
They could, well, they had their own leniencies in terms of also making money off it. I don't know if there's... Is there a prohibition for a Muslim to be a wine merchant?
No, I guess not. Although a number of them have been... you mean if they sell to Jews?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. Probably goodness.
Okay. All right. The Rambam discusses this in a couple of other contexts in two of his classic letters. One is known as Igeret Teman, the letter to Yemen, and the other one is called Igeret Hashmad, a letter on apostasy. And he has interesting, if maybe even fascinating, things to say about Islam in both. The Rambam, just to give context, at the time of the Rambam, there was tremendous strife for Jewish communities. There were threats of eradication of Jewish communities. And the Rambam was living at a time where the Golden Age of Spain, he saw the eclipse of the Golden Age of Spain in his youth, and that comes to an end pretty much in 1147. He's born in, there's some dispute, 1135, 1138, but you get the idea. He's 9, 12 years old, and all of a sudden things start to shift in the Arabian Peninsula and in Spain, and things start to go downhill in terms of Jewish-Muslim relations at that time. And so the Rambam deals with this challenge. It was his own life. For decades as a child, he ran with his family, the Maimon family, from city to city, from country to country, trying to find respite. And so he has strong things to say in that context. And he talks about these sects that arose and tried to sow doubts within believers. So he says, the first sect that arose, this is the second paragraph on source 3, the Igeret Teman, the first one to have adopted this plan was Jesus the Nazarene. May his bones be ground to dust. Mm-hmm. Very subtle. May his bones be ground to dust. And again, in this kind of context, you can understand why he would say such a thing. He was a Jew because his mother was a Jewess, although his father was a Gentile. For in accordance with the principles of our law, a child born of a Jewess and a Gentile, or of a Jewess and a slave, is legitimate. Right? If you have a Jewish mother, you're Jewish. Jesus is only figuratively termed an illegitimate child. It wasn't actually, but that's how we relate to him nonetheless. He impelled people to believe that he was a prophet sent by God to clarify perplexities in the Torah, and that he was the Messiah that was predicted by each and every seer. He interpreted the Torah and its precepts in such a fashion as to lead to their total annulment, to the abolition of all its commandments. So I said that the Rambam is on the one end of the spectrum in terms of what happened that first generation. This is one example of where he says exactly that. The sages of blessed memory, having become aware of his plans before his reputation spread among our people, meted out fitting punishment to him. Very subtle, okay? Okay, and then if you skip a paragraph, after him, and this gets even worse, arose, okay, the madman. He doesn't even call him by name, but he refers to Muhammad. It sounds so striking to our modern ears. It's hard to read. But again, you have to remember, when the Rambam was a little kid, this radical Islamic sect rose to power and butchered non-believers. They just killed them, and you know, if they were kind enough, maybe they offered them to convert. But in other cases, they just by the sword. That was it. They were done. The Rambam spent his early years fleeing from the sword. So we understand where it's coming from. Who emulated his precursor, meaning Jesus, since he paved the way for him. But you know, it's the form, right, for Muhammad. But he added the further objective of procuring rule and submission, and he invented his well-known religion. All of these men purposed to place their teachings on the same level with our divine religion, but only a simpleton who lacks knowledge of both would liken divine institutions to human practices. Judaism equals divine institutions. Christianity and Islam, human practices. Doesn't mean there's nothing there to respect or appreciate, but he calls them human practices. A religion differs as much from other religions for which there are alleged resemblances as a living man endowed with the faculty of reason is unlike a statue, which is ever so well carved, that of marble, wood, bronze, or silver. When a person ignorant of divine wisdom or of God's works sees the statue that superficially resembles a man in its contours, form, features, and color, he believes that the structure of the parts is a statue like the constitution of a man, because he's deficient in understanding concerning the inner organization of both. But the informed person who knows the interior of both is cognizant of the fact that the internal structure of the statue betrays no skillful workmanship at all, whereas the inward parts of man are truly marvelously made, a testimony to the wisdom of the Creator, such as the prolongation of the Rambam, the doctor talking. It was amazing that how he weaves it in. Such as the prolongation of the nerves and the muscles and their ramifications, the branching out of the sinews and their intersections, and the network of their ligaments and their manner of growth, the articulation of the bones and the joints, the pulsating and non-pulsating blood vessels and their ramifications, the setting of the limbs into one another, the uncovered and covered parts, every one of these in proportion, in form, and proper place. That's pretty cool, actually. The larger point, though, right, is that is a parable for the relationship between Judaism. Judaism is like the human body, and Islam and Christianity are like the statue. On the surface, they look beautiful, a wonderful edifice, but internally, only one has something that's truly profound and authentic that lies within. So this is a critique of Islam. Although it's a critique of Islam, nowhere does he take the opportunity, however, to call it idolatrous, because he did not believe Islam to be idolatrous. And indeed, to Jerry's point, and this is the last source for today, is that in his letter on apostasy to a community that was being tempted by a false Islamic Messiah, who was calling for the community to convert to Islam. The Rambam writes very explicitly that, as a matter of giving them comfort, that if someone has been in such a situation, that one need not feel that they have left the Jewish community because you chose by the sword to convert to Islam. Christianity, he would have said differently. He did say differently, but Islam, he believed, was different. It's very explicit. Verily, one who preferred to suffer martyrdom in order... He says there's an option of martyrdom. This is another opinion of the Rambam. The Rambam says you can choose to give up your life. There's an option, even when it's not mandatory. So if someone has the option, either one, the Rambam says, is legitimate. If you choose to give your life, we don't judge you. You are a voluntary martyr. In fact, we revere you for your decision to die for your faith. But if you have chosen to become a convert to Islam, that is a legitimate halachic decision because it's not idolatrous. One who preferred to suffer martyrdom in order to pronounce the Mohammedan confession has done nobly and well, and his reward is great before the Lord. He may be regarded as supremely virtuous, as he was willing to surrender his life for the sanctification of the name of God, blessed be he. Should one, however, inquire of me, shall I be slain or pronounced Sugazun, or pronounce the Mohammedan confession, my answer would be, utter the formula and live. To be sure, one should not continue to live in such an environment, but until the opportunity presents itself to leave, one should be confined to the privacy of his home and conduct his transactions in secret. For this kind of apostasy directed exclusively at compelling verbal confession is unique. A rabbi's contention of better to suffer death than to commit a transgression was never meant to imply a single transgression without action, etc. But in other words, the basic point is that the option lies before you. If you choose to suffer martyrdom, you are a tzaddik and we revere you. If you choose, however, to privately, temporarily convert to Islam, that's a legitimate decision. And again, the reason is because, it doesn't say so explicitly, but it's consistent with his view that Islam is not idolatrous. And we're going to see a couple more sources next time. You know, let me just very quickly say in a word, this is representative of one significant stream of Rishonim. Take a look on page 4. We're not going to read it inside, but I give you the Rashba, Rishon ben Azer, another great Rishon. He says, if a Muslim touches the wine, it does not become prohibited, or at least, like the Rambam says earlier, it's permissible, at least in driving benefit. He says this is where the Gaonim got their ruling that Ishmaelites, or it's based on the ruling of the Gaonim, that Ishmaelites' religion, their faith, is not idolatrous. Shari Einam Ovdim Avodazar, they don't worship idolatry. The Shulchan Aruch in source 6 in Yeredeach says that a Gentile who is not idolatrous, his wine again is permissible deriving benefit. And the Taz, one of the great classic Latter Day Achronim later commentaries, says She'ino Oved Elilim, what does it mean that you're not idolatrous? Could go in Hayishma'elim. It is, for instance, the Ishmaelites, again the same ruling, and Rav Avadya Yosef, in that same tshuva about entering mosques, says the same thing in the tshuva that I gave you over here, and he cites another ruling along very similar lines, and he quotes the opinions that we said. He quotes the Rambam, right, refers to the view of the Gonim, and the Rambam, and the Rashba, and the Rama, who all say it's not idolatrous, and therefore it's permissible halachically to enter a mosque as well. So we have this whole sort of conglomerate of Rishonim and views that maintain that it's not idolatrous. What will be more confusing and require further explanation is the view that sees Islam somehow differently with regard to martyrdom and other halachot. We'll have to see is examine what is that school of thought and what might be plausible halachic and historical explanations as to how one could say that. That will, God willing, be for, not for next time. Next week is Erev Yom Yerushalayim. Last week we discussed a special shiur on Rav Goren. Rav Goren and Har Abaya, the immediate aftermath of 1967, the recapturing of the Kotel. And what was the backstory there? What was going on? And what were the different opinions about ascending Har Abaya? And what did Rav Goren really urge? And what did he really do up in Har Abaya? So we're going to get a little bit of the backstory on all of that. There's some significant controversy around what really happened there. And then, God willing, in 2 weeks we'll continue pick up with...
Erev Shavuot.
Thank you for reminding me. Last week I had initially said, you had pointed out, Lisa, that it was Erev Shavuot, and I said, oh, you know what, that won't work. I had originally said that because I thought there was no school. If the consensus is, I will be here though, I realized. So if the consensus is people want to do an Erev Shavuot, I'm happy to do it, but I don't know if people can. I don't want to apply pressure, so... What?
I can't.
You're not. You can't. You can't.
I can.
You can.
So yeah, send an email out.
We're invited out for dinner. I can't.
You can. It sounds like if it's split evenly, I'd rather make sure that as many people as possible can come to the next one. I don't want people to have to miss it. So I think that it's probably best for the larger group as a whole not to do it. So let's pass on it. And then the following week we'll have two more till the end of the year. So that following week after Shavuos, that following Tuesday, we'll do this piece. Mm-hmm. And then the week after that, I want to do a little bit on Eastern religions. I haven't done significant research. This is going to be fresh for me. I'm excited to look into this a little bit about Buddhism and Hinduism. So I have to go brush up because I haven't done too much work. So that's the plan.